The mention about the hospice, and I had been gone for a couple of weeks from our sangha here, and I had plans to go to Lake Tahoe and go cross country skiing, and to go to Kansas City and teach a retreat, and all these plans, and I got sick, and all the best plans, you know, just couldn't come about because I had this year's flu. They kind of really devastated me for about 10 days. And, you know, it's just, you know, it's said oftentimes, but for people doing a Buddhist practice or spiritual practice, spiritual happiness is not dependent on your plans and their success or their failure, at least those kind of plans. I met last Thursday with a woman, Burmese teacher, named Tintin, who's been around the Bay Area a little bit. And she is a doctor and a lay person and was trained in Burma to be a teacher. Came to this country in 1989 or so. Her husband was working for the United Nations and started teaching mindfulness practice here. And I met with her and we were talking about, you know, mindfulness and vipassana and things like this and Buddhism in Burma. And she pointed out that from her point of view, or from Burmese point of view, traditional Theravadan point of view, that the mindfulness practice we do, that we teach, the vipassana practice, that it's considered to be the frosting on the cake. It's kind of like the pinnacle of, or the highest kind of pinnacle, the highest kind of practice that they have in Theravadan Buddhism. And you know, you can eat the frosting on the cake without eating the cake, but if you do too much of that, you get sick. And I don't know if necessarily we get sick from too much vipassana, mindfulness, but the point she wanted to make is that when people practice in vipassana monasteries in Thailand and Burma, there is an assumption by the teachers there that the people coming to practice there are steeped in Buddhist values and Buddhist teachings. And so they kind of think that Westerners who come to Burma are the same way. They're just like, you know, Burmese with a slightly different background. And so they teach them straight vipassana practice without teaching them a lot of the cultural values, a lot of the Buddhist values and teachings that are the foundation for mindfulness practice. And she was a little bit slightly concerned that here in the West, how many people are practicing straight vipassana practice without understanding the importance of such things as morality and ethics and virtue and as a foundation for the practice. And she called those things the cake. The cakes are pretty good too. It isn't like, you know, that it's a chore. But one of the things in talking to a person like Tintin that inspires me is to sense her deep faith in Buddhism. And there's a sense that it's very seldom that I feel the same kind of faith in Buddhist practice from Westerners as I feel sometimes from people, Buddhists from Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka. And there's a kind of assent, a kind of sureness or confidence that I feel sometimes from the people in Southeast Asia, that even Westerners are kind of gung-ho and very, really excited about Buddhism, they don't seem necessarily have the same kind of their faith is very different. It isn't. It's more guarded or careful or tentative or I don't have any words actually to know what I'm talking about. But there's a kind of a sureness, a certainty that is really inspiring when you meet some of these Asian Buddhists. Kind of lack of hesitation. And faith is one of those important ingredients to the cake that we put the frosting on. And faith itself, faith in the Buddhism, faith in practice and in the Dharma, inspires a lot of other qualities in people and also in a culture. And some of the other wholesome qualities that rise out of faith, deep faith, of such things as honesty and joy and generosity. And it was really inspiring to me. I was talking to her about Burma and some of the different teachers in Burma. And I told her, you know, that I'd like to go there and visit these people. And she said, oh, that'd be great. If you went and visited Burma, your stay in Burma would be free. So that was nice. And then she said, and if any of your students want to go to Burma, not only will they can they go for free, but I think I'll raise a subscription or a petition in the Burmese community in the Bay Area to pay for the airfare. And that was an expression of her faith. Her, you know, she feels that people practicing Buddhism and having the chance to go and experience it in the traditional settings is so important and so worthwhile that that people, Burmese people, Thai people, with that kind of faith, will not only kind of express their own life in the world of practice, but will support other people to do it to that extent. So maybe if some of you want to take her up on it, let me know and I'll write to her and ask her how serious she was. But I think she was very serious. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about faith this evening. And there's two kinds of faith that's talked about in Buddhism. One can be called conventional faith or mundane faith. And the other can be called maybe non-conventional. It can be called transformative or transcendent faith or ultimate faith. Faith that belongs to the unconditioned world, as opposed to faith which belongs to the conditioned or conventional world. And I think that understanding faith from these two points of view is very useful for us. And simplistically, conventional phenomena, conventional things like faith or conventional wisdom or conventional action, belief, understanding, conventional faith involves relying on something. Having something that you relate to, like you have faith in the Buddha, you have faith in the practice, you have faith in the Sangha, you have faith in a teacher, you have faith in your own ability, your own experiences. You have some kind of faith in something. Ultimate faith involves a letting go of all our needs to rely on anything, on all reassurance and all support. It's a kind of faith that doesn't really have an object, that lets go of all reliance, all supports. Buddhism divides actions, our activities, whether they're mental or physical or verbal, into two categories. And this is the conventional category and the ultimate category. In the world of the conventional category, those kinds of actions are again divided into two categories. And those are those things which are considered to be beneficial, have beneficial results, and those that have harmful results for us. The classification of actions in Buddhism tends to be functional. What's the functional consequence of these actions? Do they have beneficial effects for us and for the world around us? Or do they have harmful effects for ourselves and the world around us? And that's in distinction to other kinds of options, which sometimes exists in the West, and dividing our actions between good actions and evil actions, kind of a moral category for dividing up our actions. Buddhism tends not to make moral distinctions like that, but rather tends to make functional distinctions. That if you do a certain action, does that action then lead to you feeling happier, feeling more at peace, or helping other people feel happier, is it conducive to harmony in the society around you? Or not? Is it harmful? Does it create distress or anxiety or tension or guilt or shame, the activity? The harmful activities are those which are selfish, destructive to harmony, and lead to unpleasant results. I apologize if there's too many lists here, but in the world of our actions, there are three. So there's two kinds of movements. There's movements towards beneficial effects, consequences, and harmful consequences. There are three kinds of actions then. General actions, which are kind of in and of itself themselves are kind of neutral, don't have any valence in any way. There are movements towards things, towards objects. There are movements away from things or objects. And there's doing neither, kind of just staying still. There's two ways of having those kind of three activities. There are those that lead to beneficial consequence and those that lead to harmful consequence. The harmful consequences are those that are rooted, that arise out of the three roots known as greed, hate, and delusion. That all harmful effects arise out of greed, hate, and delusion in Buddhism. Those are the kind of fundamental roots for all the harmful things we can do to ourselves and to the world around us. The greed, hate, and delusion. Greed is the movement towards things. Hate is the movement away from things, so pushing things away. And delusion or illusion or confusion is kind of standing in the middle, not knowing what to do. Opposite to those, there are three wholesome ways, beneficial ways, of moving towards things, moving away from things, or not acting at all. And these are considered to be the three wholesome roots, or three beneficial roots. And these are what's called non-hate, non-greed, and non-delusion. And they're stated negatively, but they're understood to involve such things as that non-greed involves generosity, that non-hate involves friendliness and love and compassion, and non-delusion involves wisdom and understanding. But in the world of the three wholesome roots, wholesome beneficial things, one of those three is faith. Faith has beneficial consequence in our life. It's considered to be one of the virtuous, moral, not virtuous, but one of the beneficial qualities of mind or actions to have. And faith is very closely related to craving in this system. And it's kind of like the other side from craving. Craving is when you want to accumulate and have things and desire things and want things in a selfish way, in a possessive way, just for yourself, for your own well-being, your pleasure, you want to accumulate as many possessions you can have as many clothes and much status. And you kind of want things. You want. And people who do mindfulness meditation get to recognize that kind of wanting and craving mind very well, because that kind of craving and wanting mind is one of the forces which takes us away from the present moment, where it's difficult to stay present. Faith, it said, is also a movement towards things. Where greed is a movement towards things to have, faith is always also a movement towards things, and it's towards accumulating or having that which is considered virtuous or beautiful or beneficial in our life, but without the kind of greed of wanting. The greed of wanting is harmful because it kind of kills our life, our spiritual life. If you want too much, there's kind of a tightness that happens in our spiritual faculty of awareness, and it kind of tightens it up. It's kind of never-fulfilling cycles of wanting and desire. Squashes and kills our potential towards openness and harmony and friendliness and compassionate understanding. Whereas faith is a kind of accumulation of openness, accumulation of the beautiful qualities of the mind, not as a way to kind of clamp down at them, not as a grasping hard at them, but rather a loose holding that kind of gives life to them, a kind of a petting or a caressing of those things that gives them life, acknowledging of them. So faith has many meanings. It certainly has many meanings in Buddhism. And a lot of Westerners are a little bit allergic to the use of the word faith. Because there's a tendency in the West that the word faith is associated with belief. And kind of sometimes dogmatic belief, narrow-minded belief that doesn't allow, doesn't even sometimes even tolerate other forms of belief. And certainly faith and belief is one kind of faith. But there are many other kinds of faith. There's faith which is belief. There's faith which is kind of which is knowledge. In Buddhism, that's called verified faith, where you've actually experienced the truth of something for yourself, and you verify that it's true, and therefore it becomes verified faith. It's said classically that everyone starts Buddhist practice as an act of faith. You read a book, or you hear a teacher speaking about practice, and something about the offering of practice, of meditation practice, inspires you, or something about the book or the way it's talked about or the teacher or something inspires the person to try it out. And you have no idea before you've meditated the first time whether it's going to be a good idea for you. There has to be some level of trust, maybe questioning trust, in the usefulness of, of doing this activity. So you try it out. You have enough trust to try it out, and then you find out that it helps you in your life. It has good effects in your life. And then it's called, then you've verified the benefits for this for yourself. So that's a faith which is knowledge, a verified faith. And the verified faith then encourages us maybe to go a bit further. So maybe you kind of come to a class, and you do meditation at home a little bit, and you find out this is really good stuff. And then you say, well, it seems like they're talking about going, you should try maybe a one-day sitting or a retreat. Well, that seems kind of a strange, bizarre activity to do. But there's something about the people who do that that inspires me. And maybe I have some trust in what they say about it. Maybe I'll try it for myself. And so you do that, and you find some deeper experience in meditation practice and for yourself. And perhaps then you have kind of verified faith in a deeper level. And there's also faith which is trust. And I almost prefer the word trust to faith as a translation for the Buddhist word, sadda, shraddha. Trustful confidence in oneself and in the Dharma and practice. Faith can also be the heart's intention. Faith can be a heartfelt direction that you set your life in. To desire to move your life in a direction of increased compassion, increased peace, increased heartfulness, is a beautiful thing to do in a person's life. And it's inspiring for me to meet people who have made a decision in their life, a choice, to commit their heart, commit their practice to cultivating themselves as a better person. To develop the qualities of compassion and love and peace and understanding and wisdom. So in Buddhism, faith is understood to be also to be a direction, an intention, inclination of the heart. And there are times when people lose their inspiration to practice. And I think many of us who are practicing as lay people, I think it's hard to stay inspired to keep up a meditation practice or a spiritual practice because we don't have the support, the constant kind of hourly, minute, kind of constant support that you have if you're a monastic. If you're living in a monastery all the time, or you're living in robes, or you're living a life which is constantly being reminded of what the primary intention of your life is. It's easy to remember to practice and be inspired. But a lay person who is not constantly being reminded, who maybe only comes together once a week to sit with a group of people, can easily get sidetracked, lose your central priorities for your life, and get involved in all kinds of superficial activities or other activities that pull you away. So it's easy to lose one's inspiration. And it's important then to find something that re-inspires you to make you want to keep practicing. And so one of the things you can do if you find yourself full of doubt or full of lack of inspiration is take the time to remind yourself of that which deeply inspires you in your spiritual life. You can, and that's, you know, there's many different things. And I would like to ask some of you, what are some of the things that inspire you in your spiritual life? What are some of the things you can draw on, you can reflect on, that would bring you some inspiration, so you can come back to your meditation practice. Yes.
Books that I read, articles,
Tricycle. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Taking a precept
each morning.
Beautiful.
Retreats.
Taking retreats. So what other things have you done? What other things inspire you?
Reading poetry.
Poetry.
Being out in nature.
And being out in nature inspires you to cultivate a spiritual life?
I think it gives me more of an appreciation for a sense of a higher power.
Beautiful. Yes?
Personal emotional crisis.
There's a quote by Thomas Merton that says something like, true prayer is discovered only... You're nodding your head. Remember the quote? True prayer is only discovered when nothing works anymore. Yes?
Yeah, being able to work through little irritants during the day.
Ah, so that's kind of like verified faith. So to see that you're irritated and you have some problem and you're able to work through it inspires you. Beautiful. Yes?
Meeting with the teacher periodically.
So meeting with a teacher. It's inspiring, yes.
Having like-minded friends.
I'm very inspired whenever I come here by all of you.
Having like compassion arise in a situation when I was kind of busy doing my own thing and then I'll come again something.
So a kind of spontaneous compassion arising inspires you. Where did it come from? Yes?
I'm on the receiving end, and sometimes I'll just suddenly realize, holy cow, I received a huge amount of love. And slow down and stop and realize what I just got. That really opens up the mind.
And then there's regular things that people do, kind of almost as a practice in and of itself, to re-inspire one. I mean, reading is a regular practice, and some people will read spiritual things a little bit each day. And some people will have a little altar and have something on the altar. An altar, what an altar is for me, is a sacred space, some place that you kind of reserved to hold something which is deeply spiritually inspiring for you. And you have that thing, you look at it, and that somehow inspires you to remind you of something, some deep priorities or intentions that you have. I was very inspired to meet this woman, Tintin, last week, this Burmese teacher, and to feel her faith, and to be inspired by that. And I've been on the receiving end when I was in Asia, and also here in America, of a lot of generosity, a lot of people. And being receiving people's generosity because of my practice, because I'm practicing, because people are encouraging me to practice, gives me a lot of faith that what I'm doing is worthwhile. And I'm inspired and encouraged. And when I was in Burma, there were times where I wanted to practice my very best, not for myself, but in order to be worthy, I sense, so kind of not for the acts of generosity that were done for me. I felt responsible, you know. People were supporting me. I needed to do the best I could. So there's many things like this, and that can inspire us and encourage us, and it brightens the mind, it brightens the heart, and light makes the light our life, and our life lighter and easier to have this kind of, to have faith running through our life. But all these are a kind of faith that is considered in Buddhism to be conventional faith, in that they take an object for There's a whole different kind of faith which doesn't take an object at all, which is, you could argue maybe it doesn't involve faith at all, but I think it involves faith. And that is a kind of, I guess William James talked about a leap of faith. It's taking a leap beyond all forms of self-improvement. The earlier system I talked about, which is kind of a classic Buddhist understanding, that different actions have either beneficial or harmful effects, means that you can watch what you do and choose what you do, so that at least in a spiritual sense, in our spiritual life, we can direct whether we have beneficial results or harmful results. And I think that this equation is, you know, the beneficial and harmful has to do with our inner spiritual life, not necessarily, you know, our outer life, which is so uncertain. But it's very easy if you get a sense that, oh, if I do an act of, if I do a generous deed, that's going to create beneficial effects in the future. That's a wholesome and good action. Buddhism says that's going to produce a good effect in the future, a beneficial effect, and it will. It's easy to see it sometimes. If you make a generous act today to someone, maybe tomorrow you'll remember that and you feel happy for having done this wonderful deed. And so that's a kind of beneficial effect, consequence. So it's very easy to see this kind of movement, kind of positive-negative movement, as a kind of as a forum for self-improvement and get caught up in that world. And there's nothing wrong with that, and Buddhism puts a lot of stress on the importance of laying a strong foundation of healthy, wholesome activity, wholesome actions and thought, and in order to cultivate happiness and joy in our life, which then becomes a stronger foundation for further practice. So doing acts of doing all kinds of things which are considered to be spiritually beneficial, virtuous acts, are encouraged in Buddhism. But what Buddhism also very carefully says, that these things in and of themselves will not lead to what's called the ultimate truth, or what's called a true liberation or true freedom. That they all belong kind of in the cycles of self-improvement. And if you're only interested in self-improvement and always negotiating and rearranging the furniture, you'll do that for the rest of your life. There's no end to it, actually. And you just keep doing and keep doing and get caught in that. That there's a possibility of a leap beyond self-improvement, beyond trying to improve oneself, to a unconditional acceptance, an unconditional faith, an unconditional presence for reality as it is right now. That doesn't involve making things better for ourselves or making things worse. You just take them as they are. And sometimes people will talk, people who look at the world from this ultimate point of view or from this leap of faith, will talk about everything is perfect just the way it is. And what point of view, what perspective, what kind of leap of understanding can we take to see life just the way it is as being perfect? That improvement is not necessary. We don't have to make ourselves better in any kind of way. That we can be as we are, with all our foibles and difficulties and frustrations and all our joys and beauties. It's okay. All of it is just perfect just the way it is. I feel a little bit uncomfortable to talk about the language of things are perfect just the way they are. I think what that kind of language is, it's a projection on the world of a state of mind. And the state of mind that this leap involves is a state of mind which is not involved in any form of greed, hate, and delusion. And if there's no greed, hate, and delusion in our mind, our experience of the world is unobstructed and unencumbered. And if it's unobstructed and unencumbered, then there's a kind of feeling of perfection, of unity, of wholeness, of things as they are. And that sense, that feeling then, sometimes is projected in the external world. And people make metaphysical claims about the external world. Oh, the world is perfect just the way that it is. But maybe it's okay. Maybe they're forgiven for that. And this kind of faith, the kind of ultimate faith, incorporates, maybe is the right word, encompasses, incorporates both the known and the unknown world, both the conscious and the unconscious world. And much of who we are is unknown to us. Much of who we are, much of the world that we live in is unknown to us. And the ultimate faith is a faith that somehow allows us to relax enough that we find ourselves trusting presence in the midst of this unknown and allowing the unknown to move through us, the mystery to move through us. Because it is a mystery, what's going on. What we can actually control, what we can actually do to improve ourselves or disprove ourselves, is actually a very small part of this wider movement that is our life. One of the things that I suggested at the one-day sitting on Saturday to people at the beginning of the day was that the movement of mind that tends to make meditation difficult is a movement of mind to get caught or lost in our thoughts, identify with our thoughts, whether it's fantasies about the past or the future or whatever. And a tendency for meditators is when they notice that is to come back to their breath or come back to the present moment. As a kind of turning away from that kind of thought, that kind of identification, that's very narrow and very constricted. We tend to kind of, that becomes, if you're really lost in your thought, that's your whole world, your whole reality. The suggestion I gave was that when you notice that that's happening, rather than turning away from that, take a moment, don't get rid of it, that kind of thinking, but take a few moments to get a sense, to feel that part of you which is larger than your thoughts. And get a sense of what that is and then relax into that. To relax into that. What is it that's larger than any of the concerns you have? What is it larger than any of your fears? What is it that's larger than any of your depressions or any of your preoccupations? Or what is it that's larger? And there is something larger. There's a larger sense of self, for sure. And then can we relax into that? Can we settle into that? Can we have enough trust to settle into that? How I understand faith in Buddhism, especially it's got an ultimate faith, is a kind of trust that is not so much trust in ourselves or trust in our intelligence or trust in our judgment or trust in our ability to produce desirable outcomes, but rather to trust that we can meet all our situations with openness and without greed, hate, and delusion. The trust that we can meet the situation with openness. That doesn't mean that the situation around you is necessarily always trustable. It doesn't mean the situation is going to go the way you want it. Even with the best laid plans, even with all the care in the world to try to make things go a certain way, there's no way of knowing that, you know, horrible things happen to people. Horrible things can happen to you, you know, on the way home tonight or any time. But what we learn with practice is a kind of a trust where we learn enough trust in ourselves that we can stay open in those situations. And it's a lot better to stay open in difficult situations than it is to go through a difficult situation clamped down and constricted. And I say sometimes, you know, that one of the fundamental or deepest things you can learn from Buddhism is that the present moment is trustable if you're present for it, if you're awake for it. But maybe that's not really so. That's another piece of metaphysics. It's kind of like projecting on the world again. It isn't. I don't know if the world is trustable in terms of desirable or good outcomes. But what's trustable is that I can stay open. That I don't have to add to the situation all kinds of complications that adds unnecessary suffering to my own pain, to a difficult situation. So if you take the conventional action, conventional actions in our spiritual life have either beneficial or harmful effects. The choices we make, the actions we make, have either beneficial or harmful effects in our lives. In our spiritual life, in our inner spiritual life. So trust, I believe, is trust. We can find a kind of ultimate trust or ultimate faith where we relax enough that we don't add to the harmful side of that equation, harmful side of our inner spiritual life, by our reactivity to the situations around us. So that's a little bit different, I think, than saying that the present situation is trustable if you're present for it. It's a little bit of a nuance on that. It's a little bit more careful wording of it, if you were able to follow me. I hope you were. Faith is also a willingness to be ourselves. And I think, especially if we take the leap of faith into ultimate realities that doesn't necessarily require self-improvement, it means that we have to be ourselves. We have to be willing to be someone who left their lights on. And it's wisdom to turn them off. Faith tells me it's okay to have them on. And wisdom tells me, reminds me to turn them off. So, before we end, I would like to give you a chance, maybe one or two of you, to make a comment or a question on this topic. Yes, Bill.
Is ultimate trust the same thing as wisdom, then? And I'm thinking of the cycle where you start out with trustful confidence, which leads to sitting, which leads to verification of what's been told to you, and which leads then to a certain kind of understanding, which repeats, then you get into a deeper kind of meditation, and so on and so forth, until you come to the point that the experiential evidence is so preponderant that you accumulate wisdom now to the extent whereby you do not need faith anymore.
That's good. Again, with wisdom also, there's conventional wisdom and ultimate wisdom. And it's possible to get to deeper conventional wisdom or deeper ultimate wisdom through a progressive series like that of deepening practice. But ultimate wisdom, and some people, the first taste of something more like ultimate wisdom comes at the end of a series of progressive practices like that. But ultimate wisdom doesn't require any kind of progressive practice. It's something which is accessible here and now. In the same way that if you feel your identification with thoughts or some kind of preoccupations, and then you notice that there's a larger reality present right here now, and you relax into that, that's relaxing into perhaps an ultimate form of wisdom. A form of wisdom that doesn't involve any kind of identification with anything at all, actually. So what I'm trying to say is that it's even in the world of wisdom, we can distinguish between conventional and ultimate wisdom, and that ultimate wisdom involves a leap of wisdom, and that a leap of wisdom is something that's actually very easy. It's kind of just relaxing and allowing us to be with the magic of the awe of just simply that we're alive, that things are at all.
There's another example, a very simple one that I think is a Buddhist example, and it's the example of waves, many waves on an ocean, let's say, and each wave is a sentient being, that the only thing that's common to all of the waves, the forms of the waves, is water. So therefore the wisdom there is that beyond each wave is water. That is the ground of being of the wave. That transcends, if you want to use that word, each wave.
Uh-huh.
And so in that sense, with the ground of being, then the recognition of the ground of being, the wisdom then, and would not require trusting.
Maybe. I'm not comfortable in entering into those words that you're choosing to talk about unless we have a larger discussion about what those words mean, the definition of them,
okay.
which is not the time now.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
I was wondering, the leap of faith is the ultimate faith. If that, if you can just step out and take that leap of faith, or if it's like a quantum leap and you need to build up a certain amount of energy, get a certain critical mass, if you want to look at it like that, before you can actually take the leap. You know, or if you can just do it without having, you know, a lot of input into it ahead of time.
Sometimes it happens to people out of the blue. They have no idea where it came from. And then sometimes it seems to come after a long period of intensive spiritual practice. And it kind of, the spiritual work you do kind of creates a diving board, a kind of platform which you can jump off of. And you need to have the platform to jump off. But normally, you don't want to put your foot, you don't want to jump into cold water, right? So where the leaping comes from sometimes is a mystery. But once it's happened, whatever reason, so it can be very casual, it can be very simple, it can be going out in nature and suddenly you're there with it, or it can be very dramatic at times. But once you get a little sense of it, it can be a lot easier in the future just to recall that or settle back or relax into it. And it's not something that requires a lot of work.
It sounded like it was the continual practice that sort of built up an energy that all of a sudden happened.
That's one model. That's one way it works sometimes. But anyway, it's a little bit complicated, but it requires a leap. But a leap is something we can do right now. Just relax.
Makes mistakes on the children, that's why we're not intended for one. It's a present.
Yeah. So I think now we should end. And so thank you all very much.